Good morning. It's 7:01 on July 10th, 2012. This is Cliff. Just a few things to talk about here. Yesterday, we happened to have on our local news, coming out of one of the TV stations in Seattle here, a little 5-minute segment on oyster larvae. And the reason that this is pertinent is because the discussion was a little weird relative to the language. They start off talking about the acidification of the oceans and how this is a danger to the whole planet. It's going to kill off all of the food in the oceans because all of the critters that are used to living with a certain level of pH can't live there when the pH levels change radically and it becomes an acid. And then they went on to blame the acidity, all the while showing chemtrails, but blame the acidity on too much carbon dioxide in the air, which is being absorbed by the oceans. Half-assed, really. And then they go on to focus on oyster larvae here in the South Puget Sound that are failing to thrive. Now, note the people at the Taylor Oyster Fields who they interviewed here said, hey, we don't have acidification down here in Southern Puget Sound. Which is true, we don't. It's not here yet. It's not an issue. And then they went on to, so why there was this 4-minute segment about the acidification being a problem, and then they talk about failure to thrive and tying the two together. It's like, what kind of a link are they attempting to make? The oyster people, though, had some interesting things to say. Oyster larvae are failing to thrive globally, and our local guys here, I mean, we produce good oysters in Puget Sound, in fact, well known, are even getting to the point where they're thinking about having to relocate the breeding programs to Hawaii. On the theory that the waters will be less polluted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's their issue, though, or rather, here's something that they're not aware of. It's not the acidification, obviously. They stated this. They have a failure to thrive issue. And they're not looking at the problem quite correctly, in my opinion. And basically what's going on is this. The failure to thrive does not relate to the local environmental conditions as much as those local environmental conditions are totally degraded. So we have chemtrails dumping aluminum, barium, strontium, and other compounds into the air in vast quantities at a nano level. They come on down and there's this giant electrosmog that's rolling over all of us that does dissolve into the water. And that is indeed causing a great deal of the, or participating in the acidification process. Because these are, chemistry is a little odd because these are heavy metal salts in some cases. Combining with chlorine and so on. But in any event, though, we have the situation of the degraded environment that in local South Puget Sound is not acidified. We do have the issue of Fukushima radiation. It's quite clear all over the West Coast in almost all components of the food chain tested now have found some level of contamination from the Fukushima event. This is quite true in the local seafood. There's no question about that. And it's quite true in the local waters. But it's not because of the flushing rate and the flow rates within Puget Sound and the fact that it's sort of the reverse of the Mediterranean in terms of how it flows, we get a constant flow from the mountains that of fresh water that to a certain extent has kept the radiation less of an issue in Puget Sound. So again, it is not the radiation that's causing the problems for the oyster larva. Now, here's something the oyster people are not focusing on or didn't get into, and that is that the failure to thrive is not limited to oysters. As we all know, if you're not aware of it, you should go on out and do some research, educate yourself. Failure to thrive is occurring all around the planet on a massive level. We are in, I think, the 4th largest extinction event ever. It was the 6th largest, but we passed from there into the 5th largest, and now we've passed from that into the 4th largest extinction event ever on this planet that we're aware of as humans. And we're in it right now with species dying right and left. Today, probably 2 species will go. Who knows? But it's just it's happening at a global level. And I would suspect that this is happening at a solar system level and that life forms on Mars, Venus, and other planets are also being affected by this. Now, here's where it's going to start getting really complicated. Okay, so let's do a quick review. Oyster larva people are not alone. We have failure to thrive all over. You're seeing reports of things like the, you know, destruction of crops. A lot of people will blame this on temperatures and so on, which is true. That's a participating factor. But there are areas that are not affected by temperature that have failure to thrive in the crops, where the temperatures are within a nominal range or have an addressable issue, such as, you know, they may have a drought, but they've got water to water the fields and plenty of sun, so why aren't the crops really growing? And the same thing is true of all the species dying off, etc. There is a generalized, what I'm pegging as a failure to thrive episode going on at this time. And this is accelerating. I have some evidence that comes from the energetic levels of the stream that there's been a fundamental change, and it is my supposition at the moment that this fundamental change has a side effect which we are seeing as this failure to thrive. The many species just saying, okay, that's it, you know, we can't hack this, we're packing it in. Now, here's why. At least insofar as the evidence from the stream, from meditating. Okay, so you go into your meditation, you get into whatever positions are required to get into a deep level, you get into that deep level, you pass through all those brainwave transition, and you get into your delta waves, and you start really slowing down. And then you make that transition, and you're into the stream. The stream today is much more energized than it was in 2003. Much more energized than it was in 1996 or 95, when it made that first big transition, and hugely more energized than even in the late 80s when I first fell into it, so to speak. So now this is not a purely personal observation. In other words, it's not my ability to enter into the stream is getting better, therefore I'm able to interact with the energies more and thus am more aware of them. There is certainly a component of that. We can't rule that out. But there is also a large component of change of energies within the stream itself because the very nature of the energy has changed. So it would be as though you would go to an actual river or a stream and you would see that the riverbed is covered with a certain kind of rock of a yellow color. And then you go on back and you find out that you see that the yellow rocks themselves are starting to get a little bit energized, a little bit more vibrate-y, so to speak, and they gradually transition, some of them anyway, in a sort of a spotty fashion, into a higher energized level, and they're pink. The stream is still flowing, the water levels are still flowing at the same rate, and the bottom of the stream is all the same, the rocks are the same, but they are changing, and you can observe this. So even though it may be that your perceptions of the stream are more heightened, and because you're constantly studying the stream, you're intrigued by the change in the nature of the rocks in the bottom of the stream, that you just get better at it and get more observations and become more astute at it. But that does not rule out the fact that the yellow rocks are turning pink. So we still have that level of what's going on at the stream. So now, let's get into sort of a mechanistic understanding of this and how it relates to CERN and all of this other crap that's going on. I've got to take us all the way back in the Wayback Machine, and we've got to go back into the 50s or the 60s when this little toy was invented. And the toy was a spirograph. And it was one of the first large-scale, wasn't the first, but it was one of the first in that first wave, of large-scale plastic of a particular kind, toys that came out for a mass consumer market. And now, if you've never seen one, they're really intriguing little devices, but you would soon tire of them. But basically what you do is you put a sheet of paper on a table and then you lay this plastic toy on top of it. The plastic toy is merely a series of circles that have gears, teeth notched into their outer edges and inner edges, and some eccentricities within the circles themselves that allow you to insert a pen or a pencil into one of a number of holes, and by moving the plastic toy teeth gears back and forth relative to each other, you would be able to draw a series of straight lines with joins at their ends using the spirograph, and it would draw The kinds of straight line graphics you might see produced in a computer. Now, let's see if we can describe one of these better. It would be as though it was like the Roden coil, or it would by drawing these straight lines back and forth, and they all interconnect because you just keep moving your hand around in a circle. You end up concentrating all of these little lines around a central point. And in fact, as the lines cross each other repeatedly, you get areas where your ink darkens perceptibly until pretty soon you can't tell that there's an individual line there. It just all blurs into a larger, more colorful mass. Now, the idea that as a toy was that you would use various different kinds of colors and you'd get pretty effects and so on. As I say, you would soon tire of it because it couldn't go anywhere. It was predetermined in terms of the number of things it could produce. Now, the point, though, is for our purposes, if we imagine that those individual lines are, in fact, energy in the vibration of the universe kind of a view, in the 22 trillion times a second creation and redestruction, or in destruction and recreation of the universe, then those little lines, they become energy lines. And as you see, they would zhing around and cross each other and collide and so on. And just like within the spirograph, where you would have multiple collisions at a nexus point, you're going to get a densification of those energy waves interfering with each other. And this is how atoms are actually created. So this is where it's going to get a little complicated. The atoms that are created by these energy things crashing into each other are not the atoms that we see in the material world. These atoms are, in fact, called the IU, or indivisible unit, by the Buddhist. And it's an etheric atom. It's actually an energy form that is, the energy is so dense that it actually is in a pre-material state, okay? It's pre-matter. It's not like spooky, ghosty protoplasm or anything. It's much more like a very high vibration, well, it's like one of the kind of things that CERN hunts for. They hunt for it by smashing real matter to absolute pieces. It's as though they're taking a couple of good-sized mugs of, you know, like coffee mugs, right? White ceramic coffee mugs. And they've got two battleships facing each other. And they each put a coffee mug in one of their very large guns, and they put a huge charge behind it, and these things are all precisely aligned, and they both fire at the same time, and they shoot their coffee mugs directly at each other in order that the coffee mugs might hit each other and totally disintegrate into their coffee mug atoms. Well, okay, now what they're doing is, in CERN, is they're not using coffee mugs, they're using atoms, and they're attempting to get it to disintegrate into these etheric particles. So they're doing it from the bottom up, so to speak. The energy things go crossing back and forth each other in this spirograph kind of a pattern, and they keep colliding and colliding until it becomes so dense in a little particular nexus that this pre-atomic indivisible unit that we can call a kalapaw is created. Now, these kalapaws are clumped together. You get 18 of them together, and you've got a hydrogen atom. And so that's our basis of the universe, is the hydrogen atom, material world. And the hydrogen atom is also very unique, or very interesting for us, because it's also the fundamental vibratory nature, and it probably is the signature by which intelligent species would send messages to each other, saying, hey guys, we recognize that all creation in material world has at its base core this lowest possible number, which we derive from the hydrogen ion in this particular state. And so we send you this number saying, hi, we're at least this intelligent. Are you at least this intelligent? And we would respond, nope, we don't understand what the hell you're talking about. But pretty soon we might. Anyway, though, so here's the deal. These little indivisible units, these kalapaws, are created. You get 18 of them together. And the way that they clump together, because now, bear in mind, they're actually not real matter until you get 18 of them together. And they sort of clump together, and then they become hydrogen. But here's the really, really interesting part. There's no space involved. Absolutely no space involved at all. The pre-atomic form of these guys together, you get 17 of these guys together, there's no space involved. You could not find them, so to speak, in space. But you put that 18th in there, And they glom together with the various weak and strong forces, and they create a space in which a hydrogen atom can appear. So it's like, oh, phew, there you go. There's the final piece of the puzzle. There is no space absent the atoms. So in other words, each atom creates its own space. If all the atoms were to disappear, there's nothing, because the individual atom creates the space that it's going to exist in. And so it gets to be really tricky when you start thinking about how all the atoms interacting. But basically, all of reality, including our bodies, by the way, and ourselves, is kind of like a pointillist painting. Those are really cool. You can get online and go Google pointillism as a subset of the Dadaist movement of the early 20th century in France, and you see some people that really got into some serious pointillist work. And this pointillism is a good analogy to what the universe is, because each and every one of the points goes to get with its own space. Each atom creates its own space, does not share that space with any other atom, and never will. And this gets into some really interesting stuff in terms of how cross-atomic intelligent information is shared. In other words, how do you feel things? But we won't go there today, because the point of this today is to get back to that damn spirograph. If we look at that spirograph at a two-dimensional representation of what's going on with these 18 pre-ionic, pre-atomic particles that clump, or pre-particle critters that clump together, these 18 kalopods, we note something about the two-dimensional representation. It will always hover around an empty area. So the spirograph could never bring the line directly through the middle of the circle on the paper that was involved. It could always skirt it to some degree because of the nature of the device itself. And so you were always left with an empty hole. No matter how big you made your drawing or how small, you ended up with this empty hole around which all of the little lines revolved or intersected. And so this is also how it is in reality, in nature itself. Now, when you get 18 of these critters together, there is still, because of the way that these guys clump together before they form that hydrogen atom, there is still a hole, so to speak, okay? A space among the 18 that is not occupied. A space that exists, and in fact probably is the space from which the atom will emerge later on, and from which it will determine its own size relative to its needs. In other words, a hydrogen atom creates the space to fit its size, and a uranium atom, being so much larger, creates that much larger space because it's bigger and it needs more room. And so a hydrogen atom does not create the same space allocation, if you will, as any other atom. And this is a key element as well as you go along on some of the thinking involved in this. But getting back to the whole idea of this empty hole. The empty hole within the spirograph drawing can be thought of as the area in which energy is able to transit from the energetic realm, the etheric pre-material world realm, and come into our material world. Whew. Okay, so you got your 18 critters together with a hole in the middle, and some of the energy that created those 18 critters, 18 kalopods, leaks through in the process of those 18 kalopods becoming an atom. Now, as the pulse that creates those energy things that all intersect in that spirograph fashion, that all go into creating each and every one of those 18 pre-ionic, etheric, pre-material, almost particles, as that energy goes zipping along, that pulse must cross over the boundary between the energy realm and enter into the material realm, because we're all alive. And without that pulse, we wouldn't be alive. In fact, none of our atoms would exist without that pulse. So how does the pulse make the transition? As energy, because it must. Well, there's how it does it. It does it in that space in between these 18 pre-ionic, pre-particle things, these kalopods that are clumped together. Bearing in mind that at the 17th one, there's just sort of like nothing there. But you get the 18th one there, and they all hold hands, and this thing is born, and it pops into existence as an atom. And then it stays in existence as an atom as long as the pulse is able to transit through that hole that is created by those 18 critters. Now, here's where it gets a little bit interesting. Not all atoms bring energy in. Some apparently take energy out, and there's a balance in universe between the types of atoms, and it doesn't relate to the left-right spin in molecules, although that affects the type. The energy, underlying energy form does affect whether you have left-turning molecules or right-turning molecules, and we note that left-turning molecules predominate, at least in life forms. So if we start thinking about this, we get into an issue where the energy flow coming in from the particles that are inward-flowing taps, so to speak, is that which provides the connection of the pulse to ourselves as conscious beings within the illusion of the material. We have other particles that take energy out. Have to, because you've got to have conservation of mass and energy, and so it's all got to be self-healing and it all works out. By the way, this idea of each atom creating its own space now overcomes one of the larger hurdles that I had towards time travel, which was the impact of the sudden impulse of insertion of another pulse form into a particular reality. It doesn't come in that way. The atoms are slippery, and what basically happens is that the time-traveling particle, conscious or otherwise, is sort of slides into existence within the by pushing aside the other atoms that are there and creating its own space. It still has issues with the ever-present now and omnipresent consciousness, and I can see why the energy issues involved are really tricky. But again, a side issue there. So getting back to the failure to thrive and the oyster issues. What's going on across our solar system is that we're entering an area where we've got energetic changes. This is quite obvious. The sun's going crazy, etc. Energy is being affected at all levels, even within the stream. Or I shouldn't say even within the stream, but at its very core, because the sun and all of us are manifestation of what's going on at a pre-material level. The stream itself has changed. It's much more energetic, and the types of energy are different. These changes may be permanent, they may be transitory, they may relate to our alignment with the dark rift at the edge of the Milky Way galaxy center, which actually starts occurring, I think, on the 19th of December, based on how we're going to calculate it this year. may not. I don't know where the... It's very difficult. There's no words. It's not like there's signposts or anything. All we can say is that there's some evidence that the energy is changing. We're seeing that around us in the material world, and now we're seeing it affect life forms at a serious level. This is my supposition, and this is the point of this Wujo, is that, yes, we have a degraded environment. We have a salted environment. Somebody's trying to alien form us, turn us into some other planet with the chemtrails and the other issues. They're polluting the oceans with oil and filling them full of radioactivity for a purpose. This is not an accident, folks. And they have some idea of what they're doing. But these are not the causes of what's going on at the energy level. Why some species are not energy stable enough to make the transition, I do not know. And nor do I know if humans are energy stable, because we're just beginning into the process. This is by no means the end of it. Obviously, if we're going to have some kind of a astrological alignment process in December, it must have started centuries ago, because it creeps around in little tiny increments insofar as we're concerned. And thus, we're seeing the energy levels move up incrementally as we get forward. There's no light switch. It's going to go from one level of energetic excitement into another incrementally. Now, this is where awareness creeps in. Some people are going to be more aware of it earlier. They're going to be more sympathetic to it, more sensitive. That's the situation I find myself in. And it's going to be potentially very disruptive. Well, it is disruptive right now, not potentially. We're seeing it affect people's sleep. We're seeing the craziness go on. It would not surprise me that a lot of the zombieism is not the result of, no matter what mainstream media wants you to understand, the result of these weird drugs. It may be the result of people who are experiencing an energetic change level and have common drugs in their system. For instance, they may just be on regular antidepressants and not taking any other kind of strange drug, but because of the nature of the energy level changes, this kind of thing occurs in their brain. The implications of these Energy changes are huge. Are we going to get more atoms that take energy out? It doesn't appear that way. Right at the moment, it appears that there's more atoms that put energy in, although the types of energy coming through the holes in between the 18 kilopods also appears to be, if you will, more excited, more energetic. All of this stuff, though, relates to the oysters, in that it may be that oysters are going to be one of those species that doesn't make it, in spite of what we do. It may be that we see vast quantities of die-off of all kinds of species that share an energetic component. Let me just put it that way. I think we will see all kinds of hassles, and are seeing it now in our environment, that are deliberately attempting to cause us problems. And so, for instance, the salmon might be being poisoned more by the aluminum than the radiation, but the net result is the same. On the other hand, we have more energy coming in, and therefore it is my supposition that we must be at a transition boundary that will bring us to a temporary state, and during that temporary state, again, I don't know how long it'll last, maybe 40 years, 100 years, who knows. During that period of time, I suspect not only will species themselves alter, those that transit through, but that we'll get a whole lot of new and more interesting species, because complexity is increasing. And so the level of complexity may mean that, you know, bears learn to talk, who knows. But we may indeed see existing species transit through and then become something else as a result of this. I don't know how dramatic it'll be. I don't think we're all going to start sprouting green horns from our heads, but it's certainly, there is something occurring at an energy level. Now, in support of that, we have recently got the NASA's Explorer Voyager craft at the boundary level of the solar system, and lo and behold, as I had imagined, indeed they've discovered that there's something different here. It's not just a vacuum. We're not able to just keep these things going, and they don't just keep sliding off into interstellar space. In fact, they not only slowed down when they got close to the boundary level, now they are able to actually appreciate the boundary level as a highly energetic, charged particle area, which they as scientists in any event, are not saying why it should be there, not even discussing that component of it. But that is another aspect of the energy situation here. It's much more energetic on the outside of our solar system than it is internally. And the friction level that creates these energy boundaries themselves are changing. So those may change dramatically as we go forward, which may restrict things coming into our solar system. It certainly will make it much more difficult to get out, but also we could see it go the other way, and it may get more accommodating and let other stuff in. Again, it's not possible for us to anticipate this because none of us have ever lived through one of these cycles. I'm assuming that this cycle is very close to the 26,000-year cycle, the previous peak, not 13,000 years, which is the half cycle in which we go into the other polarity. And that may be one way to think of this. I hate bringing up the issue of polarity because people have a tendency to think of it in terms of positive and negative, which colors their thinking. But if we simply saw it as A and B, or, you know, Q and R, or something like that, as simply two different designators, then indeed it may be an issue that we're getting into a different kind of space, and that the stream itself is being impacted as we get into this space, and that the area of space we go through is determined by where we are in our cycle, that is to say the precessional cycle of approximately 26,000 years. And it may also be that the nature of the space we're going to be going into is going to bring in more particles, and thus leads us to think about a golden age because we have more energy, can do things differently, etc. And it may also be that this process has started a number of years back, say it took its big jump in 1998 when we crossed the boundary to align with the Milky Way galaxy core, and it'll probably take another appreciable leap in December as we cross and align with the dark rift off to the side of the core of the Milky Way galaxy. That's actually what the Mayans were all hot on. They didn't care so much about the center. They were all hot on the black hole, the giant mother, as they called it, for all things within the galaxy here. And they knew that we weren't part of it, but we're going to join it too. Anyway, so all of this stuff's going on. We have the stupid yucky powers that be with their degrading economic system and all that kind of crap going on. At the same time, can we say that any of those are not merely side effects? The whole upside down, in and out, nothing makes sense, complexity level increasing rapidly, but not in any organized fashion, self or otherwise. That kind of thing may just simply be a side effect of the nature of the energy change. If that is the case, then we can expect an increase in outrageous behavior, quite bizarreness, maybe zombie apocalypse will come upon us, and not because of what we thought, not because of, you know, viruses or any of that, but because of the fundamental nature of the change of the energy and people's preconditions. Which means, that's another talk, got to go into the effects of the basic chemicals that go into making up the antidepressants and their impact on your brain. Okay, so, that's really it, though. The failure to thrive thing is going to hit us all over. It's going to hit crops, it's going to hit, I think, many different species all around the planet, and we're going to have to adapt. This is one of those deals where humans are now going to have to be very innovative as we go forward and respond to and harmonize with the changes we find around us. We may find that a number of what we thought of as our food crops disappear, don't have them anymore, can't grow them. Well, you know, then we're going to have to look around and see what else the universe is providing for us towards the nutrition end. We may also find, you know, curiously, that we need less to eat. Who knows? If there's a higher energetic state coming on in, it may be that we need not consume that much to continue. That the Krebs cycle in the lower intestine may be vastly improved in its efficiency rate. And the idea of breatharians may actually get to some level of fruition if the energy levels are so high. Basically, my thinking is that it may get to the point where we're walking around in a highly charged ionic environment where there's just a lot of energy transfer into our cells without the need to do much more than take in water, simply because water provides us with the hydrogen molecule that's at the source of all of this. Okay, so the failure to thrive thing is what's happening. The oyster deal is a symptom. We see it all over. It's going to increase. We need to start thinking about our adaptive response to that. There's a lot of other indicators that show evidence of the energetic changes that I'm saying are occurring at the stream level. Now, some housekeeping issues. That's basically the point of this. I just wanted to discuss that, but some housekeeping issues here. I won't be able to throw these things onto our site anymore, the Wujos. I just can't afford the bandwidth. So what I'm going to do is to put them on payloads. We'll keep that operational for a while and probably shut down our account with that sometime this year as we go forward and work out other mechanisms with our new projects that I've got going. But so you'll probably have to look for these Wujos on the YouTube or that sort of thing as I do them. Now, Fukushima. Today's July 10th. We have expected and we've seen a great deal of the language show up relative to the Fukushima shock events. The more of the language is showing up even today relative to the floor of the reactor number 4. Bear in mind we have a 3-day plus or minus error rate here, so it may be that we'll go out to the 13th before the shock language fully matures. Around the Fukushima Daiichi power plant number 4. Until the 13th, I'm not willing to say that I won't feel sanguine about saying, whew, because it's gonna happen. It's pending. They're not doing anything about it. It's crashing. It's gonna get worse and worse and worse. Again, something else we have to react to. And I will do, I'm researching personal effective, anti-radiation or positive stream, if you want to think about it that way, approaches to our environment, but I can't get into that now because that's its whole other massive subject to deal with, and there's all kinds of cautions involved there. So Fukushima, let's wait until the 13th before we can even say that we're out of the woods. But then it's like, you know, it just merely means that I was wrong in the time period. It's still going to happen. Read the information about what's going on there. There's radiation all around the northern hemisphere from this, and that's probably going to assist in this failure to thrive thing. Now, there's one other big, big pending event, and that's this global coastal event. Excuse me. I've been doing research on the pre-existing data that we've had that I was able to keep, bearing in mind we can't really keep a lot of our data. It's just too voluminous. And but I have had notes. I've kept very good, extensive notes over the years in a number of ledgers, and I've gone back through and read through a lot of those, not all of them. And I've started cross-comparing a lot of things. So here's the nut of it at this point. None of our data on the global coastal event shows a meteor or any kind of an impact. But all of the global coastal event show two specific language groups that occur within the process of the global coastal event. First, an outgoing of the water. Maybe as much as 100 feet of the of water depth appears to disappear from some coastal areas as part of this, and thus we get the idea that it is a tsunami. On the other hand, the second component of it is this displacement wave, because it's a weird thing. Okay, in our data, the response to the global coastal event was first the disappearance of the water, and then some period of time goes by, and then the water comes back, only it comes back much further than it had before. However, within our data, there's no giant wave tops over the mountains. There's no big wave washes in and destroys cities. There is the opposite of that. There's still the city is destroyed, but it's destroyed not by a giant wave rushing over it, but rather, according to our descriptors, if you will, a tide that doesn't go out, a tide that just keeps rising and rising and rising. So in areas like I live in Puget Sound, where we have a tidal range of nearly 13 feet, in some areas here, what apparently will happen, according to our descriptors, is that the tide, well, let's just take Olympia. At its maximum tides here, we get within maybe a foot. We're in the most southernmost point of Puget Sound, which is a long, basically estuarine, brackish waterway that connects to the open ocean up near Seattle. Now, down here, when the tide comes on in, the descriptor would have the water come on up and just keep coming in. And so we would have a tidal flood in the sense that it would just keep coming on in and rise and rise, and it would overtop the local roads and just keep coming and just keep coming and just keep coming. And there would be tidal action. There's no indication the tidal action, that is to say moon activity or any of that, stops, but rather that the tidal action is on top of the larger mass of incoming water that just keeps coming in, to the point that the descriptors have capital cities, not Olympia, which we have a fairly high capital city here, but capital cities in some of the states, California specifically, that have fish on the steps of the capital. In a brackish water situation, alive, swimming around. And so the water has come in that far. Again, it doesn't show up as a giant displacement wave in our particular data set. Not to say that that isn't there, because we may not, again, have been able to forecast in any way, shape, or form a displacement wave, because it may be so far outside the parameters of A, our language, B, the psychic human, who knows. But our data does show the global coastal event. We never have gotten higher than 30% on any of the subsets of the global coastal event. It sort of trailed off, but it's never really died. Its rate of growth has been very small. Continuing, it was still in the data in the last few sets, but I look at it, it doesn't change much, so I just bypass it. It may be that indeed we have the other component of this, though. This brings us back to one last thing I want to talk about, and then I can get on with getting breakfast and getting my dishes done. The global coastal event was not directly, it showed up years ahead of this other item in our data, but one of the items in our data that showed up was a crack in the Pacific plate. And this crack was a sudden event. It did not, according to the data that was associated with the crack itself, cause a displacement wave, nor did it cause a tsunami. And that was because the crack opened up and water went down. And thus, that may account for the subset of the global coastal event, which is that the ports dry up. For some period of time, the data describes, for instance, the port of Seattle as boats not being able to reach the port because there's no damn water there. So that's not good for Puget Sound. I won't be able to sail on the mud. But apparently this is a temporary effect. So if indeed we do get a cracking in the Pacific Plate, that may account for the stuff that was showing up for the farsight.org guys in their remote viewing experiment for June of next year. That would also account for a number of the non-meteor kind of descriptors that we had on our global coastal event. Although I can't rule out that, you know, we just couldn't pick out a meteor because it's just outside of human consciousness and boom, it hits us, that kind of thing. So, there we are. Bear in mind, by the way, when I wrote the stuff about Fukushima, go back and read it. It's all about shock and the language. It's not about an earthquake. It's about the result of the earlier earthquake. So, give us the other 3 days, and unfortunately we'll probably see something happen today or these next couple of days. Not that it's going to appreciably alter our lives in any way, shape, or form. There's radiation in all of our food here on the West Coast now, and so if you eat any food from the West Coast, you got it in it, people. And we'll start thinking about our responses to radiation here and how we're going to deal with that, as well as our responses to chemtrails and the other many assaults on our health. Got to do something. Anyway, I'm going to get to it. I got chores. So, everybody get off your butt and get to work. Thanks.